So today's Wednesday, April 17th, 2019. I'm Leslie McCartney, and we're here in Nome at the National Park Service offices. And I'm with Katie Cullen, and we're with Jeanette Kelsch. Kelsch, is that how you pronounce your last name?
Kelsch.
Yes, thank you very much, Jeanette, for being with us today. We really appreciate it. You have a very, very busy week, and we really appreciate the time that you've taken to talk to us today. I'll get you both just to introduce yourselves as to what your position is here at the Park Service, and then we'll go ahead from there.
I'm Katie Cullen, the Interpretation and Education Program Manager here at Bering Lambridge National Preserve, headquartered in Nome, Alaska.
And I'm Jeanette Kelsch, and I am the superintendent of Bering Lambridge National Preserve.
Great. And again, I want to thank you, Jeanette, for participating and understanding about knowing about the project that we're doing, both with the Bering Landbridge National Preserve and with the Klondike Gold Rush National Historic Park, about climate change in these both coastal regions and parks. We'll first start off with a little bit about yourself, Jeanette. You were born and raised here in Nome?
I wasn't born here. I was born in Anchorage.
Oh.
And my family moved here when I was 11 years old. And we lived in Bethel and Anchorage before that.
So where are your parents from then?
My mom is from Gamble, which is on St. Lawrence Island. And my dad is from New York.
Oh. And so was your mom's family from Gamble all along?
My mom's family is from Gamble and Savunga on St. Lawrence Island.
Right.
Yes.
So did she grow up with a subsistence type of lifestyle?
Yes, she did. That was the only lifestyle that she had. I think for them it was just their normal life. And she actually went to boarding school in high school in Sitka at Mount Edgecombe and graduated from high school there.
So how did she meet your dad?
She was working in Anchorage, and my dad was in Anchorage because he gotten a job during the pipeline boom days, the oil up in the North Slope. He got a job, and they met each other.
And he decided to stay in Alaska.
Yeah. And he's been, I think he moved to Alaska in 1969 or 70. He kind of goes back and forth on those dates.
So what did they end up doing in Bethel?
My mom was an investigator for the State of Alaska Public Defender Agency. And we moved there because she got a job from Anchorage to there with the state. We stayed about a year, at least it felt like a year. And then because her family, because Nome is the hub of the region, and that includes St. Lawrence Island, and my grandparents were on St. Lawrence Island, my mom got a job here in Nome. And I think she got a job here in Nome in 1981 or 82. Maybe 82. Maybe I was 10. And so we moved here, and then we've been here ever since.
So maybe what we should do, too, is get your mom and dad's name and your grandparents' names, just so we can have them on the record.
Okay. My parents are Joe and Grace Cross. And my grandparents are Jack and Jane Endormi.
So are your parents still alive, or your grandparents, too?
My parents are still alive, and they live in Wasilla, and my grandparents died a long time ago.
Sorry. So you've been here in Nome for quite a while then?
Yes.
So tell us about your education.
I went to elementary school from, I remember, sixth grade here, and then junior high and high school, and then I went and finished college at Linfield College in McMinnville, Oregon. And then my first professional job straight out of college was with the National Park Service as a general park ranger.
So what did you study in college then?
General science. So, but it really was mostly math and physics. But I did take astronomy, geology, biology, and chemistry. So I had pretty rounded education in the sciences. So I chose the general science degree.
So what led you to the Park Service?
I had a friend who worked at the Park Service. I knew him in high school. His name is Charles Olin. To make ends meet, when I first finished school, and so I wouldn't have to live with my mom and dad, I moved in with my friend Veronica, who was working in Nome in dental at the hospital. Mm-hmm. And she had an apartment, and so we moved in together. And then I started bartending because you could make $11 an hour plus tips. Yes. And so I was bartending and at the Anchor Tavern. And Charles came in and he said, "Oh, are you finished with college now?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, what are you going to do for the summer?" And I said, "I don't know. I had applied for other jobs, but I hadn't heard yet." And he said, "Did you want to go work outside? Do you still know how to drive a boat and all this other stuff and outside stuff?" And I said, "Yeah, that sounds cool." And he goes, "We have a park ranger job open at Bering Lambridge." And I thought he was joking because I didn't know there was a national park or that we had a park office. And so first I laughed and I was like, because he kind of joked about stuff. So I thought he was joking with me. And he said, "I'm not joking." He said, "I'm working as a secretary for Rosalie McCreary. And I went to high school with her son, Obi." And so then I realized, yeah, he's probably not joking if he knows Rosalie. And then he said, "But they're looking for a park ranger." And I was like, "Well, what does that do?" And he goes, "Oh, super fun. You could just go around in boats and fly in planes and you look around in the park." And I was like, "Well, where is this park?" And he says, "Oh, it's by Shishmaref." And I was like, "Oh, okay." He goes, "Well, after the weekend, go in and talk to Dennis Carruth. And tell him that Charles sent you to apply for the seasonal park ranger job." So Monday, I went in, and at that time, our offices were in a really not-so-great spot. We were in the post office, mm-hmm. And the chief ranger's office was upstairs where the chiropractor is, but all the other park offices were down in the basement of the old jail. So I went and talked to Dennis, and he said, "Oh, cool." He goes, "Well, here's an application." And this is when you gave someone a paper application. Mm-hmm. And he said, "You could just probably fill it out right here. It's not very long." Well, now they're long, right? And you have to have a resume. So I filled out this, 2-page paper application, and I handed it back to him. And then, 3 days later, he called me for an interview. And so we sat down, and he told me what the job would entail. And then when I was sitting there, another employee that I knew, who I really didn't know worked here, was Fred Talktu. And Fred walked in, and he's like, "Hey, Jeanette." And I was like, "Hi, Fred." And he worked in subsistence. And he said, "Are you applying for the job?" I said, "Yeah." And he looked at Dennis, and he gave a thumbs up, and he went, "You can't see me do this," but he gives a thumbs up anyway. And then Dennis was all smiled too. And so we interviewed and we talked about boats. And they said, "Well, it's good that Fred came in because Fred is the one you'll be going out with sometimes into the field. And what your main job will be is to take researchers out so that they're safe. And you'll provide them with logistical support." Now, we don't do that anymore. Mm-hmm. That was super, super fun when I did do that. But I literally got called. It was a Thursday, and I got called on Monday saying that I got the job.
And what year was this, Jeanette?
1994. Mm-hmm. So it was, that never happens anymore. So I started, and it was history after that. But it was like the best job I ever had.
And you traveled that job all throughout, right?
Yeah, I went everywhere in the preserve. So I got to do coastal work in the lagoons. I got to take famous archaeologists and geologists out that I didn't know were famous, because I didn't pay that much attention when I was younger. All I knew was I was supposed to take this person to a certain spot and set up camp. And then Fred and I would go, after dropping them off, we would do like a walking patrol or a hiking patrol or another boat patrol and document visitor use, any damage of resources. We talked to local folks who were out hunting or camping or just hanging out. It was a super fun job. I got to learn from archaeologists like Gene Schaefe, the archaeology of the region. I got to take some geologists out and learn about the geology. A mushroom ecologist, mm-hmm. also, and I'm just blanking on his name now, but I remember his name because that was super fun. Some folks studying birds. I mean, it was a whole gamut of people that we got to take out and drop off or boat them around. Like my favorite place to go, of course, was Serpentine Hot Springs. So there we got to fix the buildings and help with the janitorial cleanup, even carpentry and painting. And it was a super fun, like I said, is my favorite job. Like, I didn't have to, I mean, I filled out a ranger report when I got back. We developed photos the old way. We sent them off to Anchorage, and it would take like 14 days to get your pictures back. And then we'd have to put them in the sleeves of a notebook, and every photo had to be labeled with who was in the picture and what we were doing. And then you'd have to create another sheet that had lit photo one and the longer description of that photo. And then you did a ranger report that also went in with the photos. It was really different back then, because some of my reports are handwritten. I found a few of them here. It's so weird to see what I used to write. And then some of them we typed out. And I remember having in college we used Macs for all of our labs. But then I worked for the federal government. We got these IBM computers, and I didn't even know what that was. Because the Macs were different, and they were easier to use. So I got this IBM computer, and it was like, what is this? It's a blue screen with white letters. And so we typed our reports out that way, and you had to use the control key a lot, like control P to print, control, and you kind of had to, like, I used to have to write down, like a cheat sheet of control, whatever. And that's what we, but a lot of stuff was still handwritten, and we had to have like things in triplicates. So we used different colored papers, and then you had to leave this copy with this person. The pink copy went with this person. The yellow copy was sent somewhere. And back then it was all like so different.
I can imagine you must have had a lot of field notebooks then too. If you had to go back and have pictures to match up with photos, you must have had numerous field
notebooks.
And
Fred always had the same notebook too, and he would have his field notes. And we just sit and work on them together.
So how was it that you didn't know that there was a park there? Was it because it had only been formed maybe
1981. I don't think that the park office actually had an employee until 1982 or 83. You'll have to ask Ken Adkinson. He knows that. And he was the third employee of the park, Ken was. There was the superintendent, his secretary, and then Ken, who was the chief ranger.
Do you remember who the park superintendent was at the time?
The only park superintendent, I think it was Larry Rose, but the second one that I worked for was a guy named Don Chase.
Right.
And then I worked for another superintendent after that named Dave. Oh, I can't remember his name.
It might come to you later.
Yeah, it will. It will. Yeah.
So this was a seasonal job, that you, the first one you got. So all of this happened in your first
season. Out of college, yeah. And then so after the season was over, I met researchers, and there were some from San Diego. So I went to San Diego for a few months and just, like, went from hangout to hangout because it was warm and I didn't have anything else to do. And then Dennis... I came home and Dennis said, "Do you want to work next summer?" And I said, "Sure." And then he said, "But do you want a job before then?" And I says, "Well, what kind of job are you asking me about?" And he goes, "Do you know what an interpretive ranger does?" And I was like, "No." I was like, "Do you have to know different languages?" And he's like, "No, no." He goes, "It's like visitor services. Like, you meet with visitors and you help us develop a visitor services program." And so I said, "I guess. I mean, if you're paying me, I'll start working." I said, "Well, when do you want me to start?" He goes, "Oh, in January. And then you'll just do your other job after that, your regular ranger job." And I said, "Okay." So we did that, and then I did my regular ranger job going out in the field. And then in the fall, I was getting ready to get done, and he said, "Do you know how to do school programs?" And I said, "No." And he says, "Do you want to do some school programs?" And at first I was like, "No." But then he's like, "No, it's because I could have you, you know, do some school programs as an interpretive ranger, but also, you know, branch out to do school programs on environmental education in Nome and the villages." And I was like, "Well, what does this mean, though?" I said, "I don't know." I told him I was concerned because I didn't know how to create curriculum. My programs were real sparse, even from January to May. They weren't that great. I mean, when we were still located in the post office, so we didn't get very many visitors. I think that our interpretive thing was a desk with the Unigrid brochure taped to the wall, and some and those same brochures out, the Unigrid out. So yeah, I told him, "Okay, I'll try it." I said, "But I don't really know how to do the programs." So he arranged for a ranger. Oh, the superintendent at that time was Dave Spurdies. So he arranged for a ranger named Pat. And now I can't remember her name, from Yukon Charlie Rivers National Preserve to come and teach me how to do interpretive work. So Pat came to Nome, and she helped me learn how to do that. A long time ago, you had to fill out forms for your visitor use, and you would fax them to whoever needed them, the WASO office. I didn't even know you were supposed to do that, but she helped work through that. She was like, "Well, what's your budget?" And I was like, "I don't know." And she's like, "You need to know what your budget is. So what did Dennis say?" And I'm like, "I don't know." It's like, I didn't even care about that stuff either. Like, do I have enough money to go to do a village visit? I don't know. So she helped do that. And then she brought some sample lesson plans on, I think the first one was like on water ecology, because it is Yukon Charlie Rivers. And another one was about, it didn't pertain very much. It had to do with trees. But she helped me look at the values of the park and what might be good programs. And so in the end, we did work on a program about the tundra and wetlands. And we worked that up together. And then the second one I did with her was on archaeology. So she kind of helped get me going so that I had something to take to schools. And then we I had like four programs. And what we do is I would fax schools a list of the things that I could offer them. And then they would basically call and say, hey, that sounds really cool. Most of them wanted me to do all of them in one visit. So I would go and do all of these in one, and I'd stay like 2 days. And stay at the school like Katie does now, same kind of thing. But it was so limited back then, and because I never had a formal teaching thing, I could only do those four. I can't remember what the other two were on specifically. But yeah, that's how I got it started, and then I got that permanent position through local hire.
And the permanent position was for an interpreter?
Interpretive park ranger. And then we moved from that building to this building when this building was finished. And it was so nice. This was my office.
Mm-hmm. And what year was that, Jeanette?
Oh, I want to say 1996. Mm. It was before my son Dylan was born. And he was born in 97. Okay. Yeah, and I know because I had Dylan, and Dave was great. He let me bring him here. And then my chief ranger, my supervisor changed from Dennis Carruth, who got a superintendent job in the Southwest, to Greg Dudgeon, who is the superintendent still at UConn Charlie and Gates of the Arctic. So, but they were great. They let me keep Dylan here. And yeah, I remember him in the walker, and he'd walk straight out there, and I'd have to go run after him because he'd walk straight out the door. So it was really, and Dylan's 21 now, so.
So as you grew into the position of education, did you improve upon the programs and do the schools here and in the communities?
You won a
Freemantown Award. Yeah, and I forgot about that.
It's a Freeman Award?
Alaska Region Freeman-Tilden Award.
Wonderful.
So Freeman-Tilden was a park interpreter, and a lot of the basics of Park Service interpretation started with Freeman-Tilden. He was like the first person to like write everything out and work with big parks. I can't remember what park he started at, but he was famous. And so they made us award. So, and so I worked on, there was a couple things I worked on. One was a PBS, not documentary, but it was a learning portal with PBS when the internet was first getting up and running. Mm-hmm. And then the other one was for a Project Jukebox, similar to this. It had some Project Jukebox elements, but it ended up being in a different style, and it was called Science in Our Lives. Mm-hmm. And it was a CD-ROM that played in the visitor center, and it had children's games, but it also had other cultural elements. You could click on something and it would show you pictures of the park. It wasn't even similar. It was totally different than the cool stuff we have now. But it wasn't web-based. You had to have the CD playing on it. Mm-hmm. So,
but that was cutting-edge technology at the time.
It was, and but it was really fun to make that. And we got, what was cool is we got to, because it was on a CD, we got to send it around to folks.
Right.
Yeah.
So what topics were on the CD then?
It was all about the park, the natural resources, cultural resources. It talked about archaeology sites. It had interviews with elders. It had stories. It had games for kids. It had information about the park, like how to visit the park, how to get there, things like that.
Hmm.
Yeah. And so it would be like what the website would be, kind of.
Right.
Yeah,
Today.
Of today.
Do you still have those interviews from the elders preserved somewhere?
I think they have that those interviews in Kotzebue.
Okay.
I think they do.
Yeah. We have the CD ROM.
Do you?
We do, but I don't know if we can play it.
I've played it before on the computer, but it's been a little while. But yeah, I think we can still. It's really deep.
It would just be really good to make sure that those interviews are preserved somewhere in an archive for future use, because I'm sure those people are no longer with us. Right.
Yeah.
So how long did you act as an interpreter then?
I did it for 4 years, and then I moved to work for Coeric, which is the Alaska Native nonprofit, as a economic development planner for them. Yep.
Interesting.
So,
what were you working on?
I worked on village plans. They were less economic development than they were village needs for each community in the Bering Strait region. And that was a really cool job too. And then, I worked for Aquaric for a long time before I came back to work in 2009 as the superintendent here. Was like 98 to 2009, almost 10 years at Coeric.
Right.
Is that right? 98. Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah.
That's a little more, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's more.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is that 10, 20 years? 98. I don't even know. I can't even think of it. So, yeah, and then I came back in January of 2009
as a superintendent.
Superintendent, yeah.
So the opportunity came up for the superintendent, and you seems like you would have been the most qualified.
Well, I really liked working here, and I really loved the park. And Fred was still here, and Ken, too. So it seemed like a good position to apply for.
So I know your time's limited today, so why don't we talk more about what are the responsibilities of a superintendent of the Bering Land Bridge National Preserve, and if we don't have time to talk about things that you've observed about climate change, we can do that maybe tomorrow.
Okay.
Does that sound good?
Yep, yep.
So taking over as superintendent, what's your role and responsibilities?
So the superintendent's, to me, major role is to ensure that park resources are preserved and protected for the enjoyment and use of many, many generations. Maybe preservation isn't what I'm really thinking of. It's more conservation.
Or stewardship.
And stewardship, yeah. So that whole thing really resonated with me, because one of the things that I always want is so that my kids can have the same experiences that I did and choose to live here.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I really love Nome, and it's just such a wonderful area. And so that value really spoke to me. And then as a Native person, the subsistence preference for local people that the park or preserve has under ANILCA also was also a driving factor for me, was that continued land use for local people to ensure that that lifestyle would continue. So, and I feel like that is, those are the two, to me, they're the two main purposes, is to work with my staff to ensure that those values are preserved. And then for interpretation and education, it's creating stewards, future stewards of not only the preserve, but everywhere. Like, conservation is important for everything. And so, so that, you know, being the park interpreter before, that resonated too, was teaching people, not only kids, but adults, about what they can do in conservation. and that education for folks. Kids, of course, are easier to and more malleable, but I've seen plenty of adults. You can see that look on their face when they realize that what you're talking about also is a value that they have.
And your predecessors before that, what was their values as being a superintendent very similar to that, or does every superintendent bring their own kind of values into their position?
I think all those superintendents really had that really well ingrained training of preservation and conservation, because a lot of superintendents go up the ranks totally in the service. They start at a GS5 and they move all the way up in the service. I had a break in service, which also gave me lots of education on tribal and Alaska Native issues, which I really was glad I did that. A lot of superintendents are really good at that. And I think the past ones were too. But the one thing was that they don't stay as long. Usually they're from somewhere else and they do a great job, but they are usually moving to a different job, maybe with a higher grade level of salary. Or I've known people who want to retire in a certain area of the United States, so they look for that job to retire in or go to. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Just because a lot of people come from the lower 48.
Right.
Yeah. Which, it's a different perspective, and sometimes, you need that different perspective.
What were some of the Indigenous issues that you became more aware of working in your other job that you brought to you with this job?
I think one of the things that people were confused about, and they still are hunting regulations between the state and the federal government. They can be complicated. And I know that people talked about that. Access issues, we don't allow for ATV because it damages the land. Plus, it's just not an allowable means. I can't even change that. I can't say, I'm going to allow for ATV in Bering language. That's no. So, under regulation. So, it was people didn't know how to access the park. Well, of course, the people in Shishmaref and Deering and Wales knew they could snowmobile, and that's how they do it. But there was a lot of those thoughts that somehow the federal government had taken that land and closed it up, locked it up. People couldn't use it anymore. And I heard that when I was at Kwerik. There was misconceptions around about federal land in general. People generally don't know the difference between National Park Service, Bureau of Land Management, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service lands at all. They just call it the federal lands. So, and we hear that now, too.
How do you monitor whether or not people are using ATVs in the park or in the preserve?
It's just really hard when you have a small staff. I think a lot of times we'll see it during flyovers. I think by and large people don't do it. I mean, it's a hard ride anyway. It's a lot of tussock tundra. And if you've ever hiked on it, it's bad enough. But to ride a four-wheeler and bump and bump and bump, yeah. So by nature, it's hard anyway.
Right.
So that's not a good thing, but it,
So have you done a lot of outreach then since you've been the superintendent to help clarify how the park can be accessed and by who?
And Katie and our other interpretive park rangers do a great job letting people know that these are the forms of access. But we're, and we talked to other people about how their feelings about not being able to go into the preserve. I know Katie has been working on special interpretive techniques where you engage folks on their values and feelings. Mm-hmm. And it's really cool because you're not only just hearing from them and responding in a federal way, but you're really understanding why they feel the way they do when they tell you, "I'm really mad that I can't four-wheeler to Serpentine Hot Springs." Mm-hmm. You know, the interpretation has come a really long way from just telling people information to this more interactive visitor. I want to say, like, mutual benefit between the interpreter and the local people and visitors.
So more of a dialogue as opposed to these are the rules.
Here's the information, here's the rules. Mm-hmm. Right. And, it's a really great way to go because I think the visitor who could be complaining about something also feels more heard. And then they understand, or at least they're provided the understanding of why in a way that they might feel a little bit better about why we don't allow things. There's always going to be people who are going to be mad about it, but I think that new way of doing things is going to help the Park Service a lot. Mm. I think it's really cool.
Yeah. So even though it's the Park Service is actually changing and over time in the way that they interact with local people and the general public, what trends do you see then going forward from that?
I think a great trend is more community involvement in the things that we do through education, resources, even more participation in how we manage wildlife. Tribal consultation is something that's taken very seriously here, and the needs and inputs of local people. And I see that trend, at least in the Alaska region, as we move forward, moving forward. There are just some things that we can't do, but we can try to figure out other ways. And allowing, getting that input from people and really mulling it over with them and creating mutual solutions to problems, I think is a really great direction that the Park Service is going. At least I feel like that's where we're going with all these new techniques that we're learning. I do have to tell people there are some no's. There are some hard no's, and that's not because of me. It's Congress.
What are the hard no's?
ATV.
Right.
That we have to do NEPA compliance. We have to do Section 106 archaeological compliance. We have to ensure that resources aren't damaged. So,
what is the first one you said, NEPA?
Yeah, NEPA.
And what is that? Oh, NEPA.
Yeah, the National Environmental Policy Act.
Right, okay. And those are just mandatory from Washington, and you have to do those?
Yes, we have to do that. We have to figure out if these activities that we're allowing are okay with the Wilderness Stewardship Act. There's a lot of stuff that goes into thinking about possible damage to resources and mitigating measures. It doesn't mean we can't do them. We just have to think of a way to mitigate them.
Right.
So, yeah, I'm really glad that the service is going to that to in a different way and explaining things in a way that the local public can understand.
Do you still see that there's other challenges that you need to face?
I think we could probably get into the climate change challenges.
Okay.
Because I see climate change as probably the number one threat to park resources. And how do we plan for that and not only think differently about how it affects local people, but mitigate damages. Because the preserve is an ever-changing location. It's not a museum. We can't regulate the temperature or who touches what or whatever. We have to be able to adapt to change and do that in the most responsible way possible, by still allowing access and working with local people on subsistence.
So what are the, if you had to say, these are the big changes that I've seen happen over my career, over the time that you've been here, what would those be?
One is it doesn't freeze up as early as it used to. So your season for going out in the preserve is shortened. So
because winter is the best season, the cold season is the best
winter. Winter is our busy time for local people because their main access is by snowmobile.
Right.
It is the time where they do a lot of subsistence activities. They do a lot of hunting and fishing during that time because the whole preserve is accessible. And that season is getting shorter. Rivers and lakes that they used to use aren't freezing as solid. So a river or lake that they used to go ice fishing on at a certain time of year is no longer accessible. But then it's not accessible by boat either because you're in that weird time where the ice isn't hard enough or there's not enough snowfall and ice for access. And so as that shortens, hunting seasons may change because of access. And we're going to have to identify and do some modeling to see what else might change. We have warmer, wetter winters. I correlate to that to increased snowfall. And the changes with that snowfall have caused, people might say, oh, lots of snow is good, but actually it can cause issues that we're not used to having, even in a preserve. Even in the middle of nowhere, it could cause issues with that much snow. And then another access issue I see is access to ice on the coast. And being able to do marine mammal hunting, utilizing the coastal ice. We're also getting more erosion and damage to the coast.
So when you say the ice for access to animals, because there isn't as much ice and it's not as thick?
Yes.
So people can't actually access the ice for the hunting?
Yes, to go hunting, like on the Bering Sea, too, in the Chukchi Sea. For marine mammals, primarily.
And then the lack of ice, when it's not there,
it creates more issues with erosion and storm. As we get storm surges, if the ice acts as a protecting barrier to the coast, and when it doesn't exist for spring and fall and other winter storms, it really increases erosion. And it really makes communities worried because these villages are on the coast, too. And protections that they used to have from the ice aren't there, or they're not there long enough, or the ice isn't thick enough for them to be protected.
Yeah.
So, and that causes damage to park resources as far as lack of coastal, what is it called? Not the beach, but a lot of archaeological resources are also coastal. So where you used to be protected, now archaeological resources are coming out of the berms and sloughs and river mouths that used to be fairly protected.
The banks.
Mm-hmm. Things are sloughing off into the banks where before they were reasonably protected from coastal surge.
So do you have an archaeologist who frequently does coastal surveys then to see if there are more things coming out? Because once they come out, the stratigraphy is all messed up too.
There are so many archaeological and paleontological sites, and we have a shared archaeologist, and to get that work done we probably need 30 archaeologists. We do have a study that's coming out because we did do a coastal cultural resource study, Portland State University is finishing up the report for us. What that will do was it'll give us an inventory of sites that are at most risk so that we can decide to excavate them or if they're a common feature to allow them to, yeah, to just go to the go to the beach. So,
right. Yeah.
So that will be. I'm hoping she'll be done with that soon.
Mm-hmm.
But it is an enormous job.
Yes.
Because there are so many cultural and paleontological resources. We estimate that, especially for paleontology, we don't know what's out there. Wow. So it's hard to know what to protect if you don't know where it is.
Right.
True. Yeah.
And they're only becoming visible because the coastline is eroding away, or banks of rivers, like you say, are eroding away.
Yeah, because with increased snowfall becomes different types of spring runoff.
Yes.
And different ways that the snow melts, and different times that if the snow melts too quickly, you get flooding. And there's just different. It's just different. I feel like when I was a kid, the seasons were slower in changing. Like you had a slower change, where now it's like it could be 50 degrees and it be that way, and everything just starts melting. You know. And but when I was a kid, I felt like it was more gradual, that change of season to season.
Well, even when you first started your first summer taking people out, I mean, probably even the number of weeks have changed.
Yes, the number of weeks have changed for that also.
And that's a very short, relatively short period
of
time.
And that's a short period of time too, yeah. It's definitely concerning as far as people's use of the landscape. And how do we adapt to that use and minimize resource damage? I think that's a question that all national parks around the United States are facing, not just Alaskan parks, because these bigger, longer, harder storms are happening in Texas. They're happening in Louisiana. They're happening in on the Northeast coast. They're happening everywhere like that. That change is dramatic.
And it makes me think, too, when you're talking about a lot more snow and deeper snow, how that impacts wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
Not just humans, but it's more difficult sometimes for animals to move around in deeper snow.
Yes, it's difficult for them. The freeze and thaw cycle is bad for caribou and moose in particular. It could affect number of animals, calf mortality, a lot of different things. Yeah, deeper snow is not good for moose in particular.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess it's, right now, I don't know if we're correlating the climate, the weather data, with wildlife events.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be an interesting correlation to see when we have lots of snow years, is there a reduction in population of certain species?
And the migration routes, if they're different,
mm-hmm.
if the snow is deeper.
Yeah, and no one is looking at that. That, as far as I know, I don't know if anybody's looking at snow depth with migration routes.
Hmm.
I do think that when rivers aren't freezing like they should be, I think caribou might choose different routes and things like that. But I don't know anybody who's looking at climate data in that way. Or I shouldn't say it's not like climate data. Weather data, because climate is on a bigger scale, but weather data in relationship to population or even composition of wildlife.
So we've talked about the destruction of coastline, but what about the types of vegetation? Has we've heard, you know, willows going further?
Oh, yeah, shrubification is an issue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Willows, cottonwood, I can't think of what the other alder species moving northward. We also have places where things are just have become just muck where they weren't before because the permafrost is thawing and creating really low mucky ground. And that's another issue that we're going to see is the changes to vegetation. Not just shrubification, but when you get more wetland, I think means more grassland. And that can change forage for caribou in particular.
Birds migrating.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep, and where they go.
And sometimes the shrubification can actually choke off, like, small rivers that had been there before.
Yeah, and it increases beaver activity, which was not a species hunted very much. But there are definitely reports of more beaver because now they have more food to eat. So they in themselves are changing the landscape, and people are concerned about beaver activity.
Yeah.
They're concerned, too, because they don't know what to do with them, how to eat them, how to hunt them.
Mm.
Because they're big rodents to everybody, and they're like, ooh, beavers, ew. But at some point, I think beaver might be the thing. You didn't ever know.
And it wasn't a traditional animal that was...
Not in Shishmaref whales or deering. I don't even think gnome, really. No, I think people are going to have that mindset change. Because people in the Yukon are okay with eating beavers. I think we just didn't have them as much, and we aren't accustomed to knowing what to do with them.
What about muskrats, too, then? Because they like to live in the same type of environment, no?
No muskrats.
Hmm.
I can't even think of... No, I mean, I definitely are going to be climate winners and losers, right?
Yeah.
And the analysis of that has been really interesting. And it should continue because you just never know, is that predictable? Is that model really correct? It'll be interesting to find out.
Yeah.
But yeah, beavers are definitely a climate winner in our changing environment.
I just heard a new report of one in a place I had not heard of just last week.
And where's that, Katie?
Up in the Serpentine River, in a part that I didn't think I had heard of a report in that area.
And they particularly like Serpentine Hot Springs area. I mean, what's not to like? It's hot springs.
Right.
It's beautiful. It's got a nice clean river, plenty of willows. And they have cut down all the alder trees, though, and the... Yes.
The beaver already.
Yes.
They've been very... Very busy.
And they very much like it.
And they can breed very quickly.
Mm. Yes, and we're lucky to have a wildlife biologist, Letty, on now who is going to be looking at their activity. And we're going to have to make some tough choices about the beavers. Because if we allow them to manage that area, we could lose the hot springs pool itself. Mm-hmm. And then Serpentine would still be Serpentine. It just wouldn't have a hot springs because it'd be under a water or under a lake. And the beavers would be super happy, too. It'd be a nice warm lake and that doesn't ever, ever freeze.
Right.
Right? So they could be busy. It'd be like, no wonder why they love it. It'd be like beaver heaven if it flooded that valley completely, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Letty's going to go out and look, and we're going to have a plan after the summer about what to do. Mm-hmm. We also are thinking of a hunting, trapping beaver clinic to teach people how to harvest that resource and possibly get an appreciation for it so that, you know, as a subsistence or regular hunting activity, they could help reduce the population of beavers without more invasive park action. It would, that's what I'm hoping anyway, is if they get an appreciation, they'll go out there and they'll eat beaver and, you know, tan beaver and use it to make beaver hats and mittens and nice cuffs and all that stuff.
Do you know when the first beavers moved into the Hot Springs area?
I don't recall.
I don't remember them when I was a seasonal in the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that would be a good question for the Shishmaref folks and local people is when do they first remember seeing beaver?
Mm-hmm.
I bet you Charlie Lean would know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. So with the changing vegetation, have you been aware of any new invasive species that have been entering the preserve at all?
No, not yet. Okay. Although there are some invasive dandelion species on the airstrip that we use at Quartz Creek, so we have to be really careful. But we also need to monitor for aquatic, because people go in with float planes.
So what aquatic I'm hoping, are you looking for?
I think from folks in the Wasilla Palmer area, it's like
Elodium. Elodium.
Yeah, and things like that. Mm-hmm. So if you get a float plane with that inside of its floats, and people don't check in anywhere, right? So it's not like they're coming into a main point of the park and spraying off and we're inspecting their pontoons. There's just no way to do that. So all we can do is monitor whether or not it comes in. It's the same with other aircraft usage.
Yeah.
And I think aircraft would probably be the primary way of transmitting certain invasive species.
Right. Yeah.
Just a quick little it's 3:47.
Oh, I better go.
Get ready for
the pause for today. Thank you very much, Jeanette, and we'll pick up again tomorrow where we left off. Thank you so much. Cool. Thank you.